It's a fact. Our daily bread now travels an average of 2,000 miles on oil provided by those who simply do not like us. And the price of that oil keeps going up and up and up. This leads us to ask, can we spin our grass into gas?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 496th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Pucallpa who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Jay Cruz on the boards. Hello, Jay.
Hey, how you doing?
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello.
And producer Kelsey Olson back from college. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Folks, it's on September 11, 2001. I had my hand an article in Foreign Affairs magazine by Richard Lugar and James Woolsey entitled The New Petroleum. In this article, Lugar and Woolsey made note of the fact that two-thirds of the world's proven oil reserves lay under the sands of the Middle East, and that as China and India increase their consumption of those hydrocarbons, getting enough to the United States will become increasingly more problematic. As if to prove their point, on that day, the World Trade Centers crumbled on TV screen, and they kept crumbling day after day after day, and we still see them crumbling occasionally, but it was certainly a portent of things to come. But wait, Lugar and Woolsey also said that an emerging new technology would allow us to, like Rumpelstiltskin, spin straw into gas. Since 9/11, we here on the Food Chain have featured a number of the world's leading experts on cellulosic ethanol, and we always ask them the same question. Will it be possible to spin our grass into gas? Yes, the experts tell us. And so today we pause to ask, when? Here to help us find an answer, we have David Bloom, author of the forthcoming book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas. David, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning, Michael.
So, how did you come to write about gas or alcohol and gas? What led you to that whole notion?
Well, I first learned about alcohol almost accidentally back in college and discovered there was this enormous history of this country and the whole world running on alcohol long before gasoline ever existed. In fact, the Model A was a dual-fuel vehicle designed to run on alcohol or gasoline. Because once you left the city, there was no gasoline. You had to stop by a farm and get alcohol, usually made from apples. Basically, when the people moved out into the Midwest, you know, they were told by their Bible, thou shalt not drink the beverage of the grape. But no one said anything about apples. So
everybody still made
so
a lot of apples.
That apple moonshine is what got people around.
Huh. So we always ask our guests, who pays the way? Are you writing on behalf of anybody?
No, actually, the book has been completely financed by individuals who've either given us grants or lent us money, but no corporate or institutions have given us any money to do this.
Okay, so nobody's paying you to say anything that you don't want to say then?
No, that's precisely why we did it this way.
Okay, also with us today, as soon as I get my little arrow out here, we have Nathaniel Green, who's a senior policy analyst for the National Resources Defense Council. Welcome to the Food Chain, Nathaniel.
Hi, Eric. It's actually the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Okay, Natural Resources Defense Council. It was my typo early this morning that did that. What is the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council?
We're one of the largest environmental nonprofits. We work on all sorts of environmental issues at the state and national level. We have over 600,000 members and over 1 million activists. To get to your funding question, we're about half funded by our members and half funded by foundations and wealthy individuals.
Okay.
Also, no corporate money either.
Okay. How did you become interested? How did the Natural Resources Defense Council become interested in ethanol?
Yeah. I'm one of the energy experts at NRDC, and I work primarily on renewable energy, all type wind, solar, power. And for a long time, the environmental community had been talking about bioenergy, biomass, as an important renewable source. But there was a lot of uncertainty as to exactly what that meant. So we started digging into that about 5 or 6 years ago and trying to really understand where the technology stood and which ones were the most promising. And you can use biomass to make heat, like a wood stove is a perfectly good example of that, but you can also do it on an industrial scale. You can also use biomass, and biomass just means sort of any plant matter, really, mm-hmm. To make electricity. But about 3-4 years ago, I started really focusing on making fuels out of biomass and what we call biofuels, and trying to really understand what role that could play in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, reducing our addiction to oil, and helping our economy.
Well, let me start it off by asking you the same thing I've been asking all kinds of people, Lee Lind, Charles Wyman, a whole bunch of people I've been asking this question. Will it be possible to spin our grass into gas? David, let's start with you.
Well, actually, people have been making, you know, plant fiber or cellulose into alcohol for more than 100 years. Henry Ford did it on his research farm. We did it during World War II when we were cut short of supplies and we needed to have alcohol to make war material and rubber and that kind of thing. Georgia-Pacific paper mills, actually, most of them originally were World War II alcohol plants that turned wood into alcohol. And most of these use what's called the weak acid hydrolysis technology, which is very well proven. It's been around more than 100 years. There are still plants operating that use this technique in Russia.
What does that mean?
Well, basically, you take whatever the cellulosic matter is. Say it's sawdust or wood or waste paper or old blue jeans. Any of those things are cellulose. You put it under about 300 to 400 pounds per square inch pressure at about 300 or 400 degrees with a little bit of acid. And the cellulose, which is really millions of sugar molecules all linked together, dissolve into basically two classes of sugar. Some sugars that are easily fermented by average everyday yeast, just like your bread yeast. Mm-hmm. And then another group of sugars that either can be fermented by GMO yeast, which I'm not so hot about that, but that can also be used to produce butanol or methane. Methane, of course, being natural gas, is useful to run the whole alcohol plant. So cellulose can both provide the sugars needed to make alcohol for fuel and its own energy to run the plant.
So once you have sugar, you're in business. Nathaniel Green, one of the big technological breakthroughs that we're right on the verge of making here would seem to be the genetically engineered enzymes that will make the decomposition of these cellulose fibers into sugars much more efficient, correct?
That's right. It's a question of speeding up the process and improving the yield, the amount of cellulose we actually convert to alcohol, to ethanol. And then also trying to do it in fewer steps. The way we have to do it right now is a sort of batch process where we do one piece of the conversion in one vat, and then we literally move it to another vat. And right now the process requires about 4 vats, depending on exactly how you're doing it. The brass ring, the gold standard of what we're shooting for, would be to be able to do it all in one vat. Faster, higher yields, and in one piece of equipment, so you don't have to spend a lot of money on hardware.
Mm-hmm. Let's you know, for many years now, we've been working at developing a grain-based ethanol economy in the Midwest. We've been subsidizing our farmers to the tune of billions and billions of dollars to encourage them to grow corn. And we put the corn in and we mash it and we use the juices and we ferment them and cook them up and we got alcohol. What is the difference between that grain-based ethanol and cellulosic ethanol? Can you give us a quick thumbnail, David?
Well, there's really no difference in the alcohol. Starch is just an easier to break down material than cellulose. It's made up of chains that are only 35 sugars long instead of tens of thousands. So we can use very common enzymes that, for instance, the same enzyme you have in saliva or the same enzyme in bread mold, which are industrially produced for less than a penny per alcohol gallon produced. When it comes to cellulose, the goal of trying to use enzymes to produce the alcohol is actually kind of a tail wagging the dog at this point. The pre-treatment that has to go on to expose the cellulose so that the enzymes can get at it actually takes one or two more machines up front compared to, say, the almost single tank that we can use with corn.
Mm-hmm.
But other crops don't even need enzymes at all. For instance, sugar beets, which yield two to three times what corn does, have sugar already in the form yeast need, and we don't have to use any enzymes. Same is true of sugar cane, sorghum, lots of
crops. You're a fan of the grain ethanol?
Yeah, absolutely. What I'm looking at, though, is the whole thing about cellulosic ethanol. I've been going to conferences for years, and we always say it's 5 years from now.
When is the question? What do you think out there? Will we be able to spin our grass into gas? This is the Food Chain. I'm Michael Olson. Today we're talking about biomass ethanol, taking our plant waste and our plant feedstocks and turning them into fuel and getting out from underneath those who do not like us so much. You're, of course, invited to participate. Pick up your phone and join us today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned. Right back after these important messages.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, sad but true, but it's a fact. The price of gas keeps going up and up and up and up and up, and it doesn't seem to go down at all. And given the fact that China and India are now in the market for that same hydrocarbon, you know that it's not going to get cheaper. So sooner or later, we've got to figure out something else to do. And there is something else to do. Now, that one of those things is ethanol, and I saw a piece recently that said you folks at the Natural Resources Defense Council believe that ethanol is every bit as viable as hydrogen. Is that true, Nathaniel Green?
We think it has at least a good chance of being the sustainable fuel of choice in the future. There are challenges to both technologies, but we think ethanol is extremely promising. Of course, there are things that people can do today. You can certainly use ethanol today if you happen to live next to one of the roughly 600 gas stations that sells ethanol. But much more easily, you can go out and buy a much more fuel-efficient car, choose to live in a community where you don't have to, you know, get in your car to go mm-hmm. buy a quart of milk.
Like New York City, right?
Yes. those sort of options are not obviously not things that everyone can do easily, but they are.
Yeah, conservation is number one, right?
Exactly. Easiest, quickest way to save yourself a buck.
Well, let's go to the phones right now because I think Bill will lead us into a good question here. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, we're talking about the future of our fuels. How are we going to power our economy when gasoline just becomes way too expensive? And it's headed that way, as everybody who bought a gallon of gasoline in the last month knows. Let's go to Bill. Folks, phone number is 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Bill, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yeah, I got several questions for your guests. I understand that ethanol costs about $120 a barrel. Is that true?
Well, good question. How much is ethanol?
Ethanol actually is much less expensive than gasoline. Ethanol can be produced for about 90 cents per gallon, which puts it down there about $30 a barrel. Temporarily, ethanol is up around $40 to $50 a barrel because of the phase-out of MTBE and the oil companies having to find something to make up the volume, the difference. And so they've been buying all the ethanol that's available. So they're paying about $2.30 a gallon right now for it to put in our gasoline. But if you organize into what we talk about in our book as a community-supported ethanol project, you can set up your own station pretty inexpensively and buy the alcohol just like the oil companies do and cut the price to quite a bit less.
Nathaniel, do you have something to add there?
No, David's got it exactly right. We're in a temporary supply crunch, but the industry is growing at 25% a year. And the cellulosic technology, we think it has the potential to get down to probably below 50 cents a gallon.
50 cents a gallon retail? Boy, does that ever sound good.
Not retail, though, Michael.
Not retail. Like,
right now in Brazil, they're doing weak acid hydrolysis with the fiber left over from crushing sugarcane at less than 50 cents a gallon right now today.
So wait a minute. You're telling us that in Brazil they're manufacturing a cellulosic ethanol for less than 50 cents a gallon?
At one plant, yes. And they've had a pilot plant running at what I would call the farm scale, about 250 gallons per day for over 3 years, doing this very same thing. So now they're up at the 2,500 gallon per day level, which is, you know, a debugging scale before they go to 10 times that size. But you know, they're using a very simple variation on weak acid hydrolysis, no enzymes, no proprietary organisms, no GMO-derived products, and they're doing it very nicely.
Yeah, wow. That's mostly out of sugar cane, though, correct?
No, that's out of the bagasse, the fiber left over after they've crushed it, got the juice out to make alcohol. The fiber that's left over is mostly cellulose or wood fiber, and that's what they're also converting into ethanol, at least at one plant now.
Yeah, but Brazil is growing sugarcane to make the alcohol out of.
Well, listen to them now.
Yeah, let me answer that. We use grass. Brazil uses grass. Our corn is an annual grass that we turn into alcohol. In our case, a third of the energy in the plant is in the corn cob, and two-thirds is in the stalk. In Brazil, where they use sugarcane that is perennial, in other words, you don't have to plant it every year, two-thirds of the energy is in the alcohol produced from the thing, and a third of it is in the fiber left over. They're both grasses. They're both carbohydrates. As soon as you bring cellulosic ethanol into the picture, the yields are similar. Right now, the yields from sugarcane are about double that of corn, but there are crops we can grow in this country instead of corn that rival sugarcane.
Sugar beets?
Well, sugar beets are a good one. Fodder beets are even better. They can yield over 1,000 gallons per acre, and several projects in Germany are about to do just that. We can also look at things that you wouldn't think of normally as crops. For instance, we have 70 million square miles of mesquite growing in this country. It's a nitrogen-fixing tree that grows in the deserts. We can get over 400 gallons per acre just from mesquite pods. That's a large percentage of our current gasoline supply just from weed trees.
There's no way we're going to be able to make, 20 million barrels a day that we use?
Okay, good. Now, good question. This is just pie in the sky, right?
Isn't it true, though, that Brazil, because they're on the equator, they have a much larger growing season, and things grow much more rapidly? From my understanding, they get, for every unit of energy that they put in to make the ethanol down there, they get like 8 units back out of it. Where here, we put 1 unit of energy into making the ethanol, we get a half more of energy from the plant.
You've asked two very important questions there, so let me take the first one first. Can we make enough? We can easily make enough alcohol if we switch away from corn and start to grow crops that provide combined feed and fuel. For instance, going up from 250 gallons an acre with corn to 1,000 gallons per acre with sugar beets or fodder beets is a good start. But we can go out there much further. There's a lot of land that isn't even considered farmland. Like all over the Southwest, where we have taken prairies and made deserts, it takes 100 acres to grow one cow there right now. But though, there are crops we can grow in those arid areas without irrigation, like buffalo gourd, pimelons, nopales, which is a kind of cactus, and mesquite, that all yield double what corn yields. And this is in land that is not even considered farmland.
Let me go to Nathaniel. Nathaniel, can we grow enough to supply our needs?
I think there's two things that seem clear to me. We can grow a heck of a lot more than we are right now. We consume about 140 billion gallons of gasoline a year, and we're only producing 4 billion gallons of ethanol. We can produce way more than 10 times what we're currently producing. On the other hand, I think the other thing that's clear, between now and 2050, our demand for gasoline or light-duty vehicle energy is expected to double. So if we don't look at the big picture, if we only try to solve this with a single technology, ethanol or biodiesel or even just vehicle efficiency, we can't do it. We need to bring all of our resources to bear.
Well, I would agree with that, you know, there's no point in trying to make more fuel without also trying to reduce the amount we use.
Right.
But
conservation,
you know,
number one.
Yeah. Now, you brought up the 140 billion gallons of gasoline that are used a year. In another unit of energy, that's 15 quads or quadrillion BTUs of energy. The American Gas Association, which you wouldn't exactly label them as tree-hugging environmentalists, you know, or biofuels promoters, but they calculated that off the coast of California alone, we could produce 26 quads of kelp, which would provide, you know, all the fuel we would need. And we're not even talking about land now. The dead zone, which many of, I'm sure the listeners have heard about in the Mississippi, where nitrogen fertilizer flows from the Mississippi into the Gulf and poisons basically 20,000 square kilometers of ocean, is prime growing space for kelp. And
folks,
we can be growing all we need.
Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Nathaniel Green, Senior Policy Analyst, Natural Resources Defense Council. David Bloom, author of the forthcoming Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Do you think we will be able to spin our gas into grass? Give us a ring and let us know. It's a fact, folks. Our daily bread now travels an average of 2,000 miles on oil provided by those who simply do not like us. And the price of that oil keeps going up and up and up and up, and it does not appear to be headed down anytime soon. So this leads us to ask, can we spin our grass into gas? Can we take our plant matter and our carbohydrates and turn it into fuels? What is the difference between carbohydrates and hydrocarbons?
Well, the difference is plants make carbohydrates and hydrocarbons are what we're getting from oil. The difference is oxygen. Plants take carbon dioxide from the air, water, and sunlight and mix those into carbohydrates. In other words, carbon and hydrate, which is like hydration or water, mm-hmm. So the difference is that we're capturing solar energy using carbon dioxide and water. You'll notice nothing from the soil ends up in a carbohydrate, just the carbon dioxide from the air and the water. So when we make alcohol, nothing from the soil ends up in the fuel. So we are not burning our soil to power our cars. But you got to think, where do those minerals and nutrients go if they're not going into the alcohol? Well, the byproduct that's left over, the mash that's left over, contains all of that. An experiment that I ran last year showed that if we return that to the soil instead of using chemical fertilizer, not only did we get 10% more than we needed to produce the next crop, but it also suppressed all the weeds when we used this with corn. So that meant we didn't need chemical fertilizer, which is $100 out of the $200 a farmer spends on an acre a year, and we didn't need the $50 worth of Monsanto's Roundup, because the weeds were suppressed. So instead of a farmer making $50 in a good year, he'd make $150 in a good year, and that is big news in corn country. So the ecological method of making fuel is also practically the organic method of growing corn. This basic idea works across many crops, so we don't have to do it just with corn.
Nathaniel Green, do you see any environmental benefits to biomass fuel stocks as opposed to hydrocarbon fuel stocks?
Absolutely. There's tremendous potential, especially moving forward to dramatically improve the environmental performance of the agricultural sector. And I think some of that, there are crops that we can use to make biofuels that are easier to grow in a sort of environmentally gentle way. Simply because they are easier doesn't mean that we will use them, A, or grow them in that environmentally softer way. Mm-hmm. I think the important thing is to sort of separate our agricultural policy from our energy policy and realize that we're not going to fix all of the concerns folks may have about agriculture by growing biofuels. There's nothing inherent about growing biofuels that's going to make agriculture better or worse.
Why not?
So we need. Well, because you can grow. We can grow corn today in a very environmentally damaging way, uh-huh. or in a very environmentally beneficial way. We can grow switchgrass in either way as well.
Same thing,
or
yeah.
we can grow, any of the energy crops that people talk about, well or poorly, and so. We need good agricultural policy, and that's a hugely important issue. The Farm Bill is up for reauthorization next year. We need to significantly grow the conservation title of the Farm Bill. If we want farmers to stay on the land and be good stewards of the land, we've got to be willing to pay for that sort of good performance. And if we want biofuels, which I certainly think offer a whole host of benefits by themselves, and we want them grown sustainably, then we have to be ready to put those two pieces together. But there's no silver bullet here. You got to do the work.
Always no silver bullet. Well, what the heck? We'll keep looking for one here at any rate. Bill left us with a question. We seem to get so little net energy gain from our corn ethanol in the Midwest. It seems like we're spending $5 to get $6 or something like that. Why bother, David?
Well, it's always possible to do a good thing stupidly, as Barry Commoner used to say. And this is also what Nathaniel was pointing out, is that you can do things well or you can do things poorly. If you take a look at the models where alcohol does return an enormous amount of energy for the amount put in, primarily Brazil and India, there are a couple of things you notice right away. First of all, just as I mentioned earlier, all the nutrients left over in the liquid mash are returned to the soil. So we're not depleting the soil of nutrients, and we're increasing soil biology, which is really the source of all fertility, not chemicals.
Feeding the soil.
The second thing in Brazil and also in India is that they don't use petroleum fuels to produce the alcohol. In Brazil, they take some of the fiber left over from crushing the cane and use that in boilers to produce electricity and heat for the alcohol plant, but they export two-thirds of the electricity back into the grid. In India, they take the liquid byproduct, also from sugar cane, and they put that in a methane digester. That produces methane gas, which runs the alcohol plant, produces electricity, and produces a surplus of energy. In America, we don't have that kind of thinking in our business. We, have a simple formula where there's ingredients that come together, a product gets created, you throw away the waste and sell the product. But when we start thinking about things in a systems approach, you can start to do things like take the liquid that's left over from making alcohol. You can use it to raise spirulina, which is a nitrogen-fixing algae. You can feed tilapia with it, which are a fish, and then take the tilapia manure in the water and use it to fuel your next energy crop.
Sounds like some kind of permaculture thing, David.
Yeah, except that Archer Daniels Midland already does it. They They have a 5-acre, set up in Decatur where they raise tilapia on the byproduct from corn, which they take 3 cents a pound byproduct from corn, the dried distiller's grains, and make $3 a pound fish from it. And they deliver the fish to restaurants live in trucks running on biodiesel. So if corporations of that size, we can do it on the small scale just as well.
Wow. Bill, you got any follow-ups?
Yeah, one last one. I'm wondering why, as a citizen, we should believe the environmental groups when they never said a thing about the MTBE for 10 years and polluted the water.
Nathaniel?
I would beg to differ. We've been fighting MTBE for a long time, and we're never happy about it. So I don't think that's a fair accusation.
Well, you know what's really great is that it's true the environmental organizations have been fighting tirelessly for 10 years to get rid of MTBE. MTBE was put in gasoline specifically because the oil companies did not want to use ethanol to clean up the emissions of gasoline. And so now when they've gotten caught poisoning our water supply, I mean, 90 million Americans now drink MTBE-laced water because of leaks. The oil companies have now quietly gotten out of the MTBE business because the Democrats stood up to the rest of government in the last energy bill and would not give a liability exemption to the oil companies.
Got to pay to clean it up, right?
Yes, they didn't.
Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with David Bloom, author of the forthcoming Alcohol Can Be a Gas, Nathaniel Green, Senior Policy Analyst, Natural Resources Defense Council, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Please do stay tuned. Well, check the price of gas lately. It seems to just keep going up and up and up and up, and it doesn't seem to be any stopping it. So we must, absolutely must, find some way of fueling our economy. Some suggest that the way to do that is through hydrogen. Others are pointing to our grass and our plant matter and saying if we can run on hydrocarbons, we can run on carbohydrates. Why not? Is the question that many say there is no reason why not. We can do this. And today we want to ask when. When? Why can't we do this right now? What are we waiting for? David?
Well, actually, Michael, we are doing it right now. There is an enormous amount of money pouring into building ethanol plants right now in the United States.
Green ethanol plants, like government-subsubsidized ethanol?
Let's deal with this subsidy thing once and for all. If you look at the subsidy that gasoline gets with all the tax breaks it gets, the military protection it gets for its tanker routes, it's well over $5 a gallon. Ethanol gets a 61 cent a gallon tax subsidy.
51 cents?
Well, it's actually 61.
51 or 61, okay.
It's 61, Nathaniel, because there's also a 10 cent so-called small producers credit in addition to the 51 that they all get, but only two or three plants are larger than small, so it's effectively 61. And the oil companies take that credit when they blend it with gasoline. But, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. What the model we're setting up with in Santa Cruz is a driver-owned station. You see, since you're one of the owners of the station, you can take the credit instead of the oil companies when you use straight alcohol. So if you're only paying, say, $2.50 a gallon for the alcohol at the pump, maybe $3 right now because it's up a little bit, you get to take 61 cents off your taxes. So that's a pretty nice incentive. The incentives for alcohol fuel have worked very well. Back when the incentives first got passed in the 80s, it cost $2.50 per annual gallon of production to build an alcohol plant. Now it costs only about $1 per annual gallon. And so we're able to produce alcohol for 90 cents a gallon from corn. 75 cents of that is the corn. So if we go ahead and start producing it, let's say here in Santa Cruz or in your county.
Any town, USA.
The largest crop in the United States by some calculations, by weight, are grass clippings. And grass clippings are cellulose. So if every county had an alcohol plant, and there's no reason why they couldn't, turning the green waste and cellulose into alcohol, we would be replacing a lot of our fuel. And the difference is, the recent study in Wisconsin showed that for every dollar spent on alcohol production in Wisconsin, 67 cents remained in Wisconsin in the economy, where, of course, when you buy transnational oil, almost 85% or more of it leaves your county forever and goes to some bank account in a transnational corporation. So what does that mean? What it means is, you know, the guy at the alcohol plant who makes a good salary now can go ahead and have his hair cut in town. He can go out to dinner. That money he spent now is taken by the person who's working in the restaurant, goes to a mechanic in the area, gets their car fixed. That money keeps circulating up to 22 times before it leaks out of the economy through Walmart or some other company.
Nathaniel Green, it would seem to me that a decentralized economy like this is a real threat to some interests.
Well, I think it is. On the other hand, I think there's some interesting developments going on right now that I think really suggest that we're maybe close to a tipping point on this issue. And it's funny that David should mention Walmart. Obviously, you know, a whole host of sustainability issues related to a company like Walmart. On the other hand, they are one of the largest independent gas station owners in the country. And you know, we're sort of, at this moment, we're sort of stuck in this catch-22 situation to a little bit, to some degree, because most consumers don't choose ethanol. They don't even know that it could be a choice. You go to your gas station, maybe there's a small amount of ethanol blended in to your gasoline, maybe there isn't, but it's not something you can choose. And so the gas stations sort of say, well, no one's coming in and asking for this stuff. On the other side, the auto manufacturers have been basically bribed to sell about 5 million vehicles on the road now, right now, that can use either gasoline or ethanol. They can go back and forth without any perceptible difference to the driver. But none of those vehicles are used on ethanol because there's so little available at the pumps. And so many of the owners of those vehicles don't even know they could do that. So
if we had a Walmart,
right, if Walmart got involved and decided to put an ethanol pump at each one of their gas stations, suddenly you would have, three times more gas stations across the country. And they could do exactly what David's talking about. They're a big enough buyer. They could go out and contract for ethanol much closer to the actual marginal cost, the 90 cents per gallon that David's talking about, and sell it for under $2 a gallon, just like David's talking about doing.
And if you could buy ethanol for $2 a gallon and gasoline is $3 or whatever it's going to be per gallon, then you buy the ethanol, right?
Exactly. What? So that's exactly the sort of game-changing situation I think we could see. If you look down in Brazil, there's a lot of people point to Brazil as this sort of golden example of how ethanol can really change a country's transportation sector. And there's both a very positive story down there and a cautionary story. They got involved in ethanol back in the 70s under a military dictatorship, which simply said, we will use ethanol. Then when the oil prices tanked in the 80s, suddenly there was actually a shortage of ethanol. And a lot of people that had bought dedicated ethanol vehicles couldn't find ethanol at the fueling stations, or if they could, it was very expensive in comparison to the gasoline. So a lot of people were left with a very bad taste in their mouth about alcohol, as they call it down there. Now, in just the last 3 years, they've seen the advent of what we call the flexible fuel vehicle. This is the vehicle I was talking about that can use both gasoline and ethanol. And just driven by consumer demand, this year 75% of all new vehicles will be sold in Brazil will be flex fuel vehicles. Consumers now in Brazil see this as a choice that they want to have. They're still getting about 40% of their transportation energy comes from ethanol. That's obviously, I say only, but that's a huge accomplishment. But still, it's not that they've totally totally taken over their whole transportation sector. But it's being driven at this point by consumer choice. So I think, you ask, what do we need to do to get this to happen? we need to get to that tipping point. And it doesn't take, you know, mandating, you know, every pump in the country or every vehicle in the country or every gallon of our motor vehicle fuel to be ethanol. We need to get to the point where consumers see this as a real choice. And, you know, as we go into the driving season now with Memorial Day weekend, more acutely than ever, people should realize when they go to the gas station, they have a choice between oil and oil and oil. And if they could choose...
If they had a choice between oil at 3 and gas at ethanol at 2, they take the choice. We've got to take a quick break. Folks, right back when we ask the final question, when? Do stay tuned. Well, folks, we're back to close up the show on biomass and grain ethanol and coming up with an alternative to the hydrocarbons that are locked in the sands of the Middle East. What can we do to fuel our world when those hydrocarbons become unavailable or too expensive to use? We have David Bloom, who's the author of the forthcoming Alcohol Can Be a Gas. We have Nathaniel Green, Senior Policy Analyst, Natural Resources Defense Council. Nathaniel Green, you talked about a tipping point. So tip us. You there?
Yeah.
Tip us. When's the tipping point? When are we going to do this?
I think the next 3 years are really going to be very exciting in the area of cellulose to ethanol conversion technology.
Okay, now I have to go quickly to David.
Basically, if we want to do it now, people can actually start doing it at a number of scales themselves. You can make alcohol even on the individual scale for 40 or 50 cents a gallon. And
just
we detail in the book.
Just start asking for ethanol, right?
No, you can actually make it yourself. It is really just moonshining. And you can convert your current car to run on alcohol or run it 50% on alcohol unmodified.
Start asking for ethanol, folks. Nathaniel Green, David Bloom, thank you so much. And thank you all for joining us. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. And hey, remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.